You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of January 2014, right here on Monocle 24. Hello from Midori House here in London, and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Tyler Burleigh. Coming up on today's show.
And every time we stay silent, the military-backed government continues to push their luck and to detain and to arrest and to harass journalists. So I really felt that if we didn't take a big stand altogether united as journalists right now, then every single one of us will be targeted every time we try and do anything.
From press freedom in Egypt to the latest in the NSA surveillance scandal, we'll review the day's top stories with Xenia Dormandy and John Owen. Then Steve Bloomfield, our foreign editor, has been traipsing around the embassies in Rome. Tough gig. We'll find out who throws the better cocktail party, the Brazilians, the French, or the Dutch. And speaking of Brazil... Sounds a little bit like Housey Chicago. We'll review that country's top tracks of 2014 with our own Fernando Augusto Pacheco right here in the studio. All that and much more to come on Midori House with me, Tyler Burleigh. So a lot to get through over the next 59 minutes or so, but first the world news with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. The French President François Hollande has been holding a news conference outlining plans for the national economy. Mr. Hollande said the economic crisis in France had been long and profound and that the country must regain its former strength. However, he's also faced questions from journalists on recent allegations about his private life, including who he thought was the First Lady of France. In other developments, Monsieur Hollande's partner, Valérie Trierweiler, is in hospital suffering from shock over the revelations of his alleged affair with an actress. Ms. Trierweiler was admitted on Friday and is expected to remain in hospital for several more days. People in Egypt have been voting in a referendum on a new constitution. There's tight security across the country, with tens of thousands of police and troops deployed during the day to protect polling stations. Correspondents say most people report voting yes for the new constitution, while a few have been boycotting it, citing various irregularities. More than 200 people have drowned on a ferry in South Sudan. They were fleeing fighting in the town of Malakal. It's the latest scene of violence a month after fighting erupted between government and rebel forces. The UN estimates more than 1,000 people have died and more than 350,000 have been displaced. The United Nations World Food Programme has launched a new emergency operation to expand its assistance to people affected by the crisis. The three-month operation aims to provide emergency food assistance to up to 400,000 internally displaced people, including specialised nutritional support for new mothers and young children who are most at risk from a disruption in their food supply. Valerie Guarnieri is the WFP's Regional Director for East and Central Africa.
Right now, we're relying on food that we pre-positioned in South Sudan for other activities. But moving forward, we're going to need at least $57 million, but likely more, in order to assist the conflict-affected people.
For a second day, thousands of protesters have marched on government buildings in Thailand's capital. They're trying to shut down parts of Bangkok as part of demands for the immediate removal of President Yingluck Shinawatra's government. Mrs. Yingluck has already called snap elections for next month, but Thailand's main opposition group has said it will boycott the vote. Gwen Robinson, the reporter in Bangkok, says demonstrators aren't ready to give up.
There are ministries being targeted and blocked, and next the protesters are planning to cut electricity and power to government facilities, and possibly SITEP has threatened to actually detain the Prime Minister and any ministers that they can physically get hold of.
At least seven people have been killed when a car bomb exploded in Nigeria's northeastern city of Maiduguri. The bomb exploded outside the state television offices at about 1300 GMT. And one of the world's largest collections of World War I diaries is being digitised by Britain's National Archives in a mammoth task which will take several years to complete. The digitisation of the 5,500 boxes of war diaries, comprising some 1.5 million pages, will allow people all over the world to learn more about what army life was like during the conflict, instead of having to travel to London to sift through the reams of pieces of paper. William Spencer is military records specialist at the National Archives.
And what we've decided to do is to digitise, to preserve the records, obviously, for future generations, very important, but also to make the material available for anybody, wherever they are in the world. Of course, prior to the digitisation, it meant people physically coming to us here at Kew to look at them.
Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, James. More from you in about 25 minutes' time. This is Midori House. We're live from London.
From London.
To New York.
To Tokyo. To Buenos Aires.
To Zurich.
To Hong Kong.
To Toronto.
To Berlin.
To Tel Aviv.
To Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. The time in London right now, it's just gone 18.06, 13.06 in New York. And joining me now with her take on the news is Zenya Dormandy, Project Director for the US program and also Acting Dean of the Academy at Chatham House. And also here is John Owen, Chairman of the Frontline Club and Professor of International Journalism at City University here in London. Happy New Year to you both. John, were the holidays good for you?
Very good. Very quiet, but it was excellent.
I sort of feel I feel like it's just sort of the second, but I took an extended holiday. But yes, I'm sort of back in the seat now. But anyway, glad that it was good. What happens at City right now? Is it new term, comings and goings? What happens at the university at this time of year?
Well, it just rolls into a different phase. I mean, the same international group of journalists that I work with, the graduate students, are back for their next term, but they're in different course structures.
You didn't scare anyway?
I tried. No, they're very impressive. It's a privilege to be with them.
Great. Then you also welcome and a happy new year to you.
It's a fantastic new year.
Is it? Tell us why.
Because it's 2014. Why shouldn't it be?
That's true.
I was about to say, the sun is shining. Oops, not so much.
At least the days are longer now in London. That's what it was. There you go. Amazing. The sun was not going down quite at 3 o'clock, which was good.
I am clearly a glass half full person. It's a good new year.
Excellent. Let's start with two stories on press freedom. First, Egypt. And, we've been covering, and earlier you heard in the bulletin, of course, the latest on the constitutional referendum in that country. But another story that we've been across, and it's incredible to look at, any number of outlets, the number of times we've seen journalists talking about just the difficulties, how many people are getting stopped in that country and how difficult it is. It's becoming from a reporting point of view. Three journalists working for Al Jazeera have been detained in a prison on the outskirts of Cairo since the 29th, held without charge. And then according to the CPJ, the Committee to Protect Journalists, we've got five others being held in the country, two others from Al Jazeera, Turkish broadcaster, a writer with a local news outlet, and also a freelance photographer. And then on top of this, John, and it was great just before we went on air that you set us up with a fantastic interview, which we're going to come to in a moment. But we've got a petition that's been created, signed by nearly 40 correspondents around the world from 29 global media organizations. And they're all showing their solidarity for the detained. Tell us, two things. Fantastic this is happening, but what's going on in the background? I mean, you'd think this is in the broad light of day. Here's a country which is still supposed to tick over because they try to fill hotel rooms in Sharm el-Sheikh and elsewhere. Set it up for us.
Well, I think the background is that there's a perception on the part of the military government that, in fact, they can do whatever they want because they're in the driver's seat. Even those who were independents and critics beforehand have swung to their side. I was thinking about the author of the Yacoubian Building, who's now come out, Aswani, who's very, very vigorously now for the military. They feel that they just simply can play off the United States against the rest of the world. There's no real pressure point that's going to make them turn away from what they intend to do. And the narrative is right now, anybody who is critical is going to get jailed or detained. I did a program with Al Jazeera in which we had a young blogger, Ala Abdullah Fattah. He simply called for protest, his support for protest. He's sitting in prison with the Al Jazeera journalist. And he's a blogger. So it's not just about journalists. It's anybody who is ranging into free expression that borders on criticism. They even called in the puppeteers because there was a puppet that appeared to be a Vodafone coded message in support of the Brotherhood.
See, if you're sitting at the Egyptian embassy in Washington, here in London, Brussels, you know, wherever you may be, you have a number of career diplomats, and they can't sort of, you know, change chairs that quickly. Again, from this, you know, external PR perception, you know, what do you think an ambassador or even, let's say, you know, a more junior minister in an embassy is thinking right now?
I think they've got a real problem on their hands because, you know, given the turnover over the last couple of years from one side to the other side, with everybody claiming that they're going to collaborate, claiming that they're going to cooperate with the opposition, claiming they're going to work together on a constitution, on governing collaboratively, and none of them are doing it. And so as a diplomat, as a foreign service officer, as a bureaucrat, you have to sit there from one to the other to the next. And what ends up happening is you lose the ability to say anything because what you're worried is, well, what happens if you know, the government changes again in 6 months? And suddenly, if I've said anything that's controversial, I'm going to be flipped over to the other side and who knows what's going to happen to me along with the journalists. And so, you know, I mean, I think that what's going on in the media is a manifestation of a far more fundamental and far more worrying problem, which is the complete lack of any desire or need in the views of the current government or the current regime to actually collaborate or cooperate.
Mm. And for those who might have missed it, how is Chatham House calling Egypt at the moment? You know, here we are 2 weeks into 2014. If you look, I mean, and of course it is difficult, but I mean, you know, are we, you know, sailing to a properly failed state here?
I don't think anybody knows the answer. And certainly, you know, Chatham House doesn't have a one voice. You know, there are a number of my colleagues who are working very closely on Egypt and many of the other countries in the Middle East, which is, of course, as we all know, for the last couple of years, has been an incredibly dynamic place. And I think it is premature for anybody to make categorical statements about what Egypt's going to look like in a year or two. I think what is perhaps a more, for the policymakers out there, what is perhaps a more pertinent question is, what kind of an Egypt do we want to see in 5 to 10 years? And what small steps can we now take that will at least urge them in a positive direction? And realistically speaking, the outside world, that I think is probably the most that they can do.
Mm. John, as I was saying at the intro, it was great that you gave us a little bit of a tip a bit earlier. And we heard from freelance journalist Shireen Tadros, formerly an Al Jazeera English correspondent based in Cairo and one of the signees of the petition. And here's what she had to say.
Well, I really feel that every journalist living in Egypt and trying to operate in Egypt really needs to take a stand right now. The fact is that many of us stayed silent when 5 journalists, including 2 Al Jazeera Arabic journalists, were detained 5 months ago. And then again, we stayed silent when the raids happened on various different media organizations. And every time we stay silent, the military-backed government continues to push their luck and to detain and to arrest and to harass journalists. So I really felt that if we didn't take a big stand altogether united as journalists right now, then every single one of us will be targeted every time we try and do anything, because there is one narrative that's being told by the local press, that's the military's narrative. And anyone who tries to challenge that, whether you are a journalist or whether you are someone on the street that's just unhappy with the way the country is being run, you are at risk of being arrested, being detained, and at the very least being harassed.
Is that journalist Shireen Tadros? John, is anyone listening, though, in Cairo to that?
I doubt it. And, you know, well, the worrying thing is, as she pointed out to me when I spoke with her earlier as well, is that they can keep renewing the extension of how long they stay. Another 15 days has been approved. This can morph into 45 days. There's no immediate prospect of any of them being released. And one of them, Mohamed Fadel Fahmy, has got a dislocated shoulder. Who knows whether he's been treated properly? They're sleeping on hard cell floors. They're isolated. They're not used to this kind of treatment. You know, again, this is not just simply, they're not just being just put somewhere and given a kind of easy go treatment. Mm. This is hardcore prison.
Mm-hmm.
If I can just pick up on something that John just said, I mean, I think what is the more fundamental problem that's behind this is the complete lack of rule of law. I mean, the fact that you can say, well, it's 15 and now it's another 5 or another 45, we can treat you any way we want, we can treat you in any conditions we want, we can arrest anybody you want. Shireen made that, you know, anybody is susceptible. It's a lack of rule of law And that fundamental, whether it's Egypt or whether it's a number of other countries in the Middle East and Asia, you know, we're looking at what's going on in Thailand at the moment as well, Russia, you know, that question of
Turkey
not being able to rely on rules that everybody abides by is what makes this so uncertain and actually so worrying over the long term for the country and the people within it.
And, you know, we keep talking about how important it is to have a democracy. I think what you said is right. What's more important is to respect the rule of law. Hmm. Get the rule of law right, then worry about a vote.
And yeah. and a perfect time to set our sights north to Russia. Another freedom of the press story. And you know, many people, of course, have heard of the story of David Satter, a Moscow-based advisor for Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty. And he's discovered that his host country considers him undesirable. Over the holidays, David Satter, American, traveled from Russia to Ukraine to renew his visa. Not an uncommon process. Gets to the Russian embassy in Kiev. Upon arriving, he's told, and this is a quote, he's been banned from entering Russia, and that, to quote again, the competent organs, whoever they may be, have decided he's undesirable. Longtime Russian watcher John, author of three books in the country, and was also the FT's man in Moscow from 76 to 82. Just, you know, carrying on with the same sense of, you know, on one side, we thought everything was looking okay, and that Russia, they're going to be allowing some type of free protest, again, whatever that might look like, in and around Sochi. What's going on here?
Well, again, sort of wondering why they suddenly denied him the right to remain. The FT itself had a piece about him, pointed out that maybe they again were parsing what he had written. What he's written several books about Putin and the Russians, and he was suggesting that the 1999 bombings in the apartment buildings were done by the security forces as a way of setting up pretext for then Prime Minister Putin to basically push the Chechen invasion. And so one of the speculations is this is just payback for that. I don't know. I mean, this new Radio Free Europe grouping that he's part of, and then you've got Putin consolidating his new sort of Radio Free Europe of Russia,
exactly,
headed by a one-time, very formerly vigorous, outspoken journalist, Dmitry Kiselyov, who's now the guy at the head of this.
Which is remarkable to watch. Do you think it is indeed just, you know, payback time, a rather sort of public tip, tit for tat?
Well, I think, I mean, what's interesting to me is, you know, you read three or four different stories and they all have a slightly different frame on the question. Is it payback? Is it that he's been expelled and he's no longer wanted? Is it that he overstayed back in November for 5 days and so it's related to that? I mean, There are a myriad of excuses that you could use if you want to find a reason to do something. You know, you'll do it. Certainly, Putin appears to be willing to do it. So I think it's. I find the terminology undesirable quite an interesting one, and I think is probably the most accurate one, which is for whatever reason he was not wanted. You know, the Olympics are starting in now 3 weeks, I think, and Putin is determined to make sure, assuming there are no terrorist attacks, that it goes smoothly.
The other thing, Satter was quoted as saying he hoped to turn Radio Free Europe into more of an original reporting investigative organization. That also might have just been a really warning. Oh my, we're going to stop that before it gets started.
And you've got to remember that it was just last year that the Russians decided to label every NGO that gets international support as a foreign agent. I mean, this is not a one-off. This is a trend that we're seeing that really should raise many concerns, and I think does.
John, no shortage of bureaus in Moscow, of course, and then, you know, this massive deployment that we're seeing in Sochi at the moment. Do you think if you're a big broadcaster, you've got the rights? You have your sports team there, and then, of course, you'll probably have all of the networks moving their morning shows and some of their news people there as well as we get days before the torch is lit. If you're a big U.S. network, Australian network, do you think people are a little bit careful right now in terms of the type of reporting they're doing?
I think that's absolutely right. They're going to be worried about the event. They've spent a huge amount of money to secure those rights. They're not going to do what the BBC at least has the freedom to do. And I was listening to the BBC's Moscow correspondent talking about the fact that he was going to nose around and see what the political climate was like. But they, you know, the BBC has the means to do that.
I mean, from your point of view, Zainab, when you think about this, and well, we can have a whole other story about IOC and how one even sort of wins the games in a place like Sochi, but we'll save that for special documentary special. Do you think the two can run hand in hand, though? I mean, whether you're a BBC, I mean, of course, I mean, CNN doesn't have the rights, but the type of reporting that, yes, let's have people, you know, around the medal circle, but are they able to then go and talk about whether it's insurgency issues, you know, gay rights issues, you know, whatever it may be right now?
Well, we saw to some extent it happen in China. You know, I mean, there's an interesting, I mean, that's an interesting model to look back on. You know, you mentioned the IOC. It's interesting to wonder, you know, China, Russia, you know, it's going to be in Middle East in 2020, is it? 2021, 2022.
Remember the World Football Cup.
Qatar, exactly. Mm. And, you know, you're seeing kind of these international sports agencies start expanding the kind of places they go and perhaps doing so with a diplomatic frame in mind, you know, sports diplomacy, you know, hasn't it worked so well? And the question is it or is it not? And I think China, you know, that's a very debatable question because there were a number of issues raised there,
and
too.
And who knows whether there's a pussy protest that could still happen at the games, again, the international media then has to focus on the story. So, you know, we don't know yet. It's early days.
We're going to take a very, very short break. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Have no fear. Zainab Dorman and John Owen are staying around for another 10 minutes or so until we get to the bottom of our news time. We're back right after this.
Each week, Section D takes a thorough look at the design world. From fashion to furniture, from lighting to tasteful living, we'll bring you the most interesting news from design studios across the globe.
Where is society going? What is the furniture that will lead what society will want in terms of furniture functions and forms?
We see that more and more contemporary designers actually do not think about the mass-produced object. That's not what drives them. That's not what they're interested in. That's not what they think they want to contribute to this world.
It's not just making clothes, but shoes and accessories and thinking about the character or the narrative of the collection.
Join me, Tom Morris, on Section D, your one-stop guide to the world of design.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Lexus.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's just gone 18:22 in London, and that would be 14:22 if you're listening in Halifax. Zainab Dorman is still here. I did the math there. Project Director for the US Program at Chatham House, and John Owen, Chairman of the Frontline Club and Professor of International Journalism at City University here in London. I want to stay in Russia for a moment, because today also Russian officials have been asking civilians to be more vigilant. You know, it's funny when you mentioned China a little bit before. It seems like one of these Chinese public service announcements and appeals that you would also hear, Zainab. And this, of course, in the run-up to the games, and of course, it's following those explosions from a week or so back. Does it strike you as slightly odd, you know, this type of appeal? And again, you know, how much of this is sort of window dressing and saying, you know, okay, yes, you know, we're out with our counterinsurgency teams, and we've put up our ring of steel already around Sochi. Oh, and by the way, media and everyone else visiting, we've also got our fair citizens on public watch as well.
It doesn't surprise me terribly much. I mean, you know, I mean, I was in the States for 9/11. I was in the States for the 13 years following 9/11. And this happened all the time in the US. I mean, you know, even today, in that you go in the tube, it's like, watch your back. So the idea that the citizens actually have to be the eyes and ears as well, I don't think that as a concept is one that is unique to, certainly not unique to Russia. I think that there's a more fundamental concern, which is, yeah, there was 34 people in Volgograd killed last week, over the weekend. The location of Sochi, which is so near to an area of unrest between Russia, Georgia, the Caucasus, that would make me very nervous if I were the one trying to keep the games safe. So the media call to the citizens of Russia doesn't surprise me at all. I think it is an indication of a real concern.
Mm. John, I want to go back to the notion of activism, but also just looking at the intersection of Russia as well. When you look at your program at Citi, the rise of the activist journalist, and we'll come to the NSA in a moment. How much has that become a topic for your program? Students sort of also probably asking, looking for your counsel, the types of positioning, they're going to have when they go out there in the world. I mean, has this sort of moved up sort of to the top of the discussion points now at school?
I think it's one of the topics, and there is a legitimate discussion about whether you can be a campaigning journalist, still practice rigorous journalism. Glenn Greenwald springs to mind. Whether you can be a rigorous campaigning journalist but have points of view and still be respected by the major news organizations. And I think the answer is yes. I think the other issue is whether you can work more closely with humanitarian organizations. Human Rights Watch is doing more rigorous journalism than many of the major news organizations in terms of investigative reporting. So it's not a black and white issue anymore. I think what is more dangerous is when you are not transparent.
Mm.
That's the big issue. It's transparency. Who are you? Who do you represent? When you're writing something, can I read it and think and know that it represents a point of view that you have declared, if it is a point of view, and what are your sources? It's sourcing and transparency. I think those are the issues.
Well, was it Frontline in the US that did the Benghazi story just 3 or 4 months ago, and only to discover that the one source that they had used was
CBS. 60 Minutes.
I apologize. You're absolutely right. The one source they used was lying.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's a great case in point of really respected organization, notwithstanding, I can't remember its name, really respected organization that, you know, fell down because of lack of transparency and lack of thorough investigation.
And that's what activist journalists or journalists who are in the style of a Greenwald say. You know, you're critical of us, and yet you look at major, established news organizations, and they're not even doing their own rigorous sourcing and vetting.
Mm. Absolutely. Just before we go, we should jump on the Acela from New York and go down to Washington. I'm sure you probably got some friends at the New America Foundation.
Yes,
of course,
indeed.
A think tank group based out of D.C. They're saying right now the bulk of phone spying conducted by the NSA had no discernible impact on preventing acts of terrorism. They also went on to say that only the most marginal impacts on preventing terrorist-related activity. Is this, for people who are in your types of business, is this news to anyone?
Not really. I mean, The problem with this is inevitably you can't win. I mean, I always think that the hardest job in Washington, D.C., other than the president, is probably the Secretary of Homeland Security, because you start at a zero. If nothing happens, you're at a zero. And anything you do wrong, you get negative points. You don't get points for getting it right.
Mm.
Well, here's a great case in point. Trying to find the balance between security and privacy, but if you don't do this and something happens, you're going to get blamed for it.
Right.
So you're going to try to put all sorts of things in place to prevent something happening. But it's, the dog that didn't bark. It's very, very hard to prove that. And so, these organizations, NSA and other intelligence organizations, are really stuck between a quandary of, they're right, maybe there's no discernible impact now, but could this be a tool that would be useful in the future? And if you choose not to pursue it and something happens, you're going to get blamed for that, so you're going to be quite forward-leaning.
Mm. John, do you think that you mentioned Mr. Greenwald, just a moment ago, this was, really sort of, certainly a story for the last 6 months of 2013. Does it mark sort of a moment in time that this was sort of, this type of whistleblowing that we saw on this level? Of course, the great chase, where is Mr. Snowden around the world, et cetera, et cetera. Does something like that play out again? Of course, we've heard lots of threats. So there's, of course, other things sitting out there. Or in some way, this is it's run its course.
No, I think there'll be probably a new phase. I mean, when you think about it, Assange is just sitting there,
Poor
in
thing.
The Ecuadorian embassy. He's like last year. You don't even hear his name now. It's all Snowden.
Exactly.
It's all Snowden. So who knows who the next Assange, Snowden, and the next revelation will come from. I don't think it's over.
No, I sort of, you know, one of the poor men, you sort of looking in sort of the back door of, you know, Herod's all the time.
You should have picked a better
one. I was going to say, you watch.
Fortunately, there's deliveries.
Yeah, maybe you can sort of see that, you know, the green and gold bags come out of the store. But I thought, you know, you're looking into the back of the food hall, and one would hope that they've at least got a good chef. But I haven't sort of seen any images. I'm wondering sort of, you know, how large he is, because I mean, you can only sort of, you know, pace around. I'm not sure if
he's got an elliptical machine in there. Apparently, someone gave him one. So. By the way, you know, it's not just bloggers and Snowden. You know, James Risen, New York Times, is in front of the American Supreme Court. You know, again, in a very fundamental case right now. So
we're going to have to leave it there, John Owen. I'm looking forward to seeing you around the Frontline Club. We're trying to sort of cook up a few things there, which we'll have to talk about in another environment. And
I'm on my way there right after.
Okay,
this.
I would like to join you for one there too. Also, Xenia Dormonesti from Chatham House. Still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll find out what's grabbed the attention of our man in Belgrade, and of course, we'll head to Rome to see what our foreign editor is up to as well, and we'll review the best Brazilian tracks with our Fernando Augusto Pacheco here in the studio. But first, a little break. News is coming up in a moment.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And it is 18:31 here at Midori House Studio 1. And you are indeed listening to Monocle 24. It is the bottom of the hour. It's time for a catch-up on the world headlines. Here's James Luckhurst.
French President François Hollande has held a news conference outlining plans for the economy. However, he's also faced questions from journalists on recent allegations about his private life, including who he thought was the First Lady of France. In other developments, Monsieur Hollande's partner Valérie Trierweiler is in hospital suffering from shock over the revelations of his alleged affair with an actress. Ms. Trierweiler was admitted on Friday and is expected to remain in hospital for a few days. People in Egypt have been voting in a referendum on a new constitution. There's been tight security across the country, with tens of thousands of police and troops deployed to protect polling stations. Correspondents say most people state report voting yes for the new constitution, while a few are boycotting, citing various irregularities. More than 200 people have drowned on a ferry in South Sudan. They were fleeing fighting in the town of Malakal. It's the latest scene of violence a month after fighting erupted between government and rebel forces. The UN estimates more than 1,000 people have died and more than 350,000 have been displaced. At least 7 people have been killed when a car bomb exploded in Nigeria's northeastern city of Maiduguri. The bomb exploded outside the state television offices at around 1300 GMT. Maiduguri is the capital of Borno State and the focal point of an insurgency being waged by Boko Haram, a radical sect that wants to create an Islamic state in the north of Nigeria. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, James, and you are back in about 28 minutes' time. But in the meantime, it's just 21:32 if you're listening in Moscow. It's actually about to go 18:33 here in London, 16:33 in Rio de Janeiro. I'll be talking and heading to Brazil to talk all things musical in a little while. But right now, time to check in with one of our correspondents. We're heading to Belgrade, where, of course, Serbian capital indeed, and our Guy Delaney is there. Hello, Guy.
Greetings, Tyler.
Happy New Year to you.
Thank you very much. Srećna Nova Godina, right back at you.
I guess I would imagine, in about 3 hours' time, the city will be well lit up with lots of firework displays?
You'd think so. It was actually New Year's Day here today. What parties there were, we've already sort of had. And it's a funny old thing. Some things in Serbia run to the Julian calendar, like Christmas was actually last week. And it's very, very seriously observed. A lot of suckling pigs go to their their fiery death at that time and get consumed by the families all around Serbia. But Orthodox New Year is far less seriously celebrated. A lot of the energy seems to go into the 1st of January, International New Year, as it were. But we did have fireworks last night at midnight, to be fair, and some musical celebrations in front of the National Assembly.
Well, does that, certainly from an economic point of view, does it create sort of a bit of an odd sort of shutdown, because you're observing, you know, let's say call it regular International New Year, and then you have to sort of come to a screeching halt again?
That's it. It's funny, just before we came on air, I was thinking about this, and I thought, actually, a lot of people in Serbia, certainly in Belgrade, seem to sort of write off January. It's a month which doesn't really happen. People disappear. They go away. They go to various different parts when they might have relatives overseas, or they might just go skiing in places in Serbia or in Slovenia. It's a month where people just do disappear because there are so many public holidays. The observance is taken seriously because it's part of the Serb identity. That they still follow the Julian calendar. And so it's very, very difficult to get things done in January in this country.
But nevertheless, our man in Belgrade, the news doesn't stop, does it, Guy?
Oh, no, it doesn't. And one of my favourite bits of news, regular listeners to Monocle will know that I pop over the border to Kosovo, or is it a border? Not if you're Serbian, it isn't, on a regular basis. And at the end of the last year, they had these very bizarre local elections in North Kosovo to elect mayors in the Serb majority municipalities there that were sort of dragged kicking and screaming to the polls, and it's already gone horribly wrong for one of the mayors there.
And what does that look like when you say horribly wrong? Because the mind, it does boggle.
Well, this is a man, Krstimir Pantic, who was basically the government's man, Serbian government's man, in North Kosovo. He was their sort of point guy who was meant to be representing the interests of the Republic of Serbia in North Kosovo. He'd been persuaded to stand as mayor of North Mitrovica, saying this would stand up for Serb interests there, even though these were elections in the Republic of Kosovo. Confused? Well, he clearly was, because he suddenly decided that he really doesn't want to be a mayor in the Republic of Kosovo at all. He refused to take the oath of office over the weekend, and now we're looking at still more elections, and this will be now the fourth bite of the cherry, trying to get a mayor elected in North Mitrovica.
Just tell us, you travel into Kosovo frequently, as you say. If I'm in a Serb area versus the rest of the country, rest of the state, do I notice a difference in terms of just economic development from you know, one side to the other?
Well, it's bad in the north, and it's really bad in the south, which is the Republic of Kosovo, as you would know it. In the north, I mean, you notice it basically feels like part of Serbia. Mm. And these four municipalities, there are only about 50, 60,000 people who live in these four municipalities. The main population centre is North Mitrovica, and Mitrovica was one single town. It's split down the river, down the middle by the Ibar River, into north and south. You've got majority ethnic Serb in the north, majority ethnic Albanian in the south, and in the ethnic Serb north, you've got Serbian number plates on the cars, Serbian schools, Cyrillic script is widely used, and Serbian food is widely served. And it, to all intents and purposes, feels like part of Serbia. And that's the problem that the people in the north have got. They don't recognize the Republic of Kosovo. It was unilaterally declared independent in 2008. And they say, we're still citizens of Serbia, and we're not going to recognize anything that's to do with the Republic of Kosovo and their government in prison.
Let's stay on the whole notion of recognition. There's something else, perhaps, I wouldn't say sort of dubious, but Republic of Kosovo recognition issue.
Absolutely. They're still not recognized by about half the member states of the United Nations. They've got about 54% now, I think, of recognitions from UN member states. But they are celebrating this week because FIFA, the football world governing body, has said they will allow Kosovo to play international friendly football matches. Now, there's a lot of conditions attached to this. Of course, they're not competitive matches. They're not going to enter the World Cup or anything like that. They're not allowed to use the national flag of Kosovo, and they're not allowed to play national anthems. Nonetheless, in Republic of Kosovo, they will clutch onto this as that one little extra piece of recognition that they've got this month.
So there's nothing can be belted out at all across the football pitch?
Absolutely not, which is rather bizarre, isn't it? Because this is the standard thing that we have at football matches. The national anthem's being played, the opposing fans booing, the players forgetting the words. All of that is of course, part of the great pageant of football. And the people of Kosovo are going to be robbed of that, for the moment at least.
Mm. I mean, May is not far away, which means Eurovision, of course. I do believe that they're recognised on the European Broadcasting Union stage.
Do you know what? They're not as far as the Eurovision Song Contest is concerned. And this was a matter of great consternation to the Deputy Foreign Minister when I met him last year. We were talking about, it was on the fifth anniversary of their independence. We were talking about, you know, the things, the challenges that were still ahead for the Republic of Kosovo. And one of the things that he kept banging on about was that they weren't in the Eurovision Song Contest. And they were all during these independence celebrations weekend. The only song that you heard time after time was Hot Right Now by Rita Ora. And I noticed today that she, of course, started out as a Eurovision contestant in 2009 for the UK. So there's the connection.
Finally, I'm supposed to throw you a riddle. What's in the box?
What's in the box is a it's a lot. It's a lot of dosh, Tyler. This particular box is the box which is known as Tito's Safe. And this was a very important, I mean, goodness knows how big this thing actually is when we come to talk about the contents in a sec. But this was all held during the communist Yugoslavia days. A lot of goodies which were supposedly in Tito's personal control, the head of the former Yugoslavia. And this box was kept closed for decades after Tito's death. It was opened in Serbia in July last year, but nobody has officially revealed what was in there. And now Serbia's neighbouring countries, other members of the former Yugoslavia like Croatia, are now saying, please tell us what's in it, because we might want some of it.
Well, I mean, the way you're actually just building us up there, it sounds like the only reason we don't know when is because they sold the rights to Discovery Channel and it's going to be a sort of a special on, you know, sometime in the next month or so. But seriously, this is the case. There's been sort of no proper accounting yet.
Absolutely not. But there are rumours. And these rumours say there's 30 kilograms of gold in there, almost 3,000 gold coins.
Is that all?
194 gold objects and diamonds that originally belonged to the Karadjordjevich royal family. So it's a healthy haul. I don't know if it'd prop up Slovenia's economy, but you never know.
Okay, well, we will. If it turns out to be late-breaking news, or you hear that some U.S. network has bought the rights to pry open that box, please let us know.
You will be the first to know.
It's Guy Delaney, our man in Belgrade. Up next, we'll ask which embassy throws the better party, Brazil or France? Stay tuned to Midori House.
There's a saying in Mexico, for everything bad, mezcal. For everything good, the same. Monocle Films visits Oaxaca to meet the people injecting new life in an ancient beverage, taking mezcal from small Mexican villages to the world's capital.
Most mezcals are produced by families in their villages, in small batches using traditional methods handed down through generations. Mezcal is traditionally a farmer's drink, a working-class spirit, but it's also one steeped in folklore and a particularly Mexican sense of magic and mysticism.
Liquid Courage, in the film's menu on Monocle.com.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
It's 1842 here in London. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tyler Brulé. It's time to play Who Has the Better Embassy? And who better to answer that question than our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. He's in Rome on assignment because not too far down the track, our March issue is going to be devoted to that very fair country. Steve, buon anno. I haven't spoken to you.
Tyler, hello from Rome. Yes, it's been a rather nice start to the year here in Italy.
It sounds like you've got a bit of a Prosecco grin on right now.
Not quite yet. No, we've actually just finished about half an hour ago at the French embassy, where we spent most of the afternoon. And this morning we're at the Brazilian embassy. As you say, Rome, despite the fact that it's not necessarily the world's most important seat of power, does still actually have some of the world's most impressive embassies. And the Brazilian and the French are both two of those great embassies. They're incredibly historic. They both used to be homes to popes, and both have some incredible furniture and, of course, frescoes on the walls.
I mean, we should probably set this up a little bit, because it seems that certainly sitting in London, we meet lots of diplomatic officials, many ambassadors, and I guess what we noticed was that certainly a couple of Nordic ambassadors, I'm not sure if that's whether it's clockwise or counterclockwise as they sort of rotate them around the world. But everyone is very, very excited, about their new posting in Rome. So, of course, we've sent you there to investigate. But it seems that it's not just, or maybe have you established, is it a place of reward? As you're saying, of course, here it is a hot story. And of course, Italy has been, a big economic issue, of course, for many other, players within this continent. But is there also the side that, you go to the embassy there and you're an hour on the Freccia Rossa, then you're in Naples for the weekend and you can be up in the Tuscan countryside in no time. Is that part of the gig?
I think it's fair to say that it's certainly not a bad gig here. I think it's interesting to note that, for example, the British ambassador, Christopher Prentice, was formerly posted in Baghdad. And it's not uncommon for certainly for the Brits and the Americans for it to be a bit of a reward after a harder posting elsewhere. But it's also, for some, it's still seen as an important place to be. So, for example, the Brazilian ambassador we met earlier today is perhaps in his 50s. He's reaching the high point of his career, but he sees the Rome embassy as a stepping stone onto another bigger posting elsewhere. I think one of the most important, one of the most fascinating things about these embassies is that, when we talk to ambassadors, often they're, when they're off the record, they accept that it's unlikely that people will be going to the streets to campaign for more money for the foreign ministries and for the wine sellers. But they know that it's really important that they have a good embassy and they put on a good show. And these embassies that we're focusing on here are great examples of countries, of governments that, yes, they have at some stage spent quite a lot of money on building an incredible palace, an incredible embassy. But that really helps them then sell their country.
So far, and don't give it all away because we want people to purchase the magazine when it hits newsstands in mid-February. But give us, obviously we've established that you're talking to the Brazilians and the French. I believe there's a visit to the Dutch as well.
Yes, we were at the Dutch on Monday, and they've got actually rather an interesting embassy because they actually redesigned it, renovated it about 10 years ago. They brought in some Dutch architects to change it around, and it's all very open and very conversational, very free, as you'd expect from the Dutch. And it's striking that it's right next door to the Israeli embassy, which is perhaps not quite so free and open. We're also going to be popping down to the Danish embassy tomorrow. While their building is perhaps just a normal Italian building, obviously inside it's got all the Danish furniture and furnishings that you'd expect. And they also have a wonderful Danish institute here as well, which is quite striking to see.
Steve, it sounds like a terribly tough gig, but we wish you the best. We look forward to seeing you back here at base in London. It's time for a bit of music right now. In a moment, we're going to be joined by our very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco for our daily review segment. Today, we'll hear some Brazilian tracks. Taking us there right now, though, is Antonio Carlos Jobim and Mucha with the song Se La Vida Tem Sempre Razão.
Sei lá, sei lá, sei não.
can't ask for a better intro than having, of course, Mr. Jobim and Miucha, the song Say La Vida Tem Sempre Razão, or Razão.
Razão. You did a very good job, Tyler, with the pronunciation.
And if you didn't recognize that voice, that is our very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And of course, if you just join us, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're fast getting close to the end of the show, but we've got a little bit of time, Fernando, to go through a couple of tracks that you've picked up. You've been on a nice trip, by the way. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Feliz ano novo, Tyler.
obrigado. Can you maybe tell us, these are some things picked up Sao Paulo, Rio, and maybe sort of set this up, I guess, from a position if I was turning on the radio in my car, I was going to a certain club, where would I be hearing the things you're about to play for us?
Well, to be honest, I chose a very different selection of tracks. In some tracks you can listen to a club, another one when you're having like your caipirinha on the beach and a very relaxed day. So there's a song for every moment.
Okay.
That sounds...
So you've the first one that we're going to look at, a gentleman named Genesee.
And the song's called De Graça, which is like for free. And you know where you should listen to the song?
Okay, tell us.
You should be in a bar in Rio having a beer with your friends. That's how I imagine.
This is the mood.
That's
that
the going
for.
And basically, Genesee is like a young singer. It's just his second proper album, but even though he's been a musician for 10 years, but only now he's become kind of a little bit mainstream, and he's the darling of the music media in Brazil.
Well, actually, now that I look at the cover, Fernando, it's like looks like you're going for a little bit of a Genesee sort of look.
He inspired me.
Yeah, he did. I can see with the onset of facial hair.
And he likes to wear tropical t-shirts as well.
Okay, great. How nice. Why don't we have a listen to the song?
Que a conta é uma só, oh, 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 oh. Você não aprendeu como desata o nó, oh, 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 oh. Livre-se do laço, solte-se no espaço, abra os braços e o coração. Sentir o sol te acordar, bem de manhã, quem acha pra comprar? Viver na pele um grande amor e seu calor, quem acha pra vender? Uma amizade verdadeira ou ir à feira só pra conversar? Somando tudo quanto vale pra você.
No, that was a little sample of Genesee with De Graça. And I'm just looking at the back of the CD cover, and it's interesting that there's a number of sponsors. I mean, aside from that, we've got the record company on here. You actually have a rather large logo in terms of a partnership with the federal government of Brazil, the Ministry of Culture. So I wanted to ask you just before we go into the other side, is there quite a big incentive program to encourage, whether it's a young emerging artist like this, as much as more traditional music as well, that you get some type of grant to get into the recording studio?
There are many, actually. And I think not only with music, but with cinema as well. If you go to the cinema and go to watch a Brazilian film, almost 100% there will be a sponsor from the government, because I think it's very difficult to get money from the private sector in Brazil. So the government's involved almost 100% in everywhere when you talk about culture. But for example, if you see like a more established artist like Ney Matogrosso, which is going to be our second guest, I mean, he doesn't need the support of the Brazilian government.
Yeah, and I'm looking on the back. I don't see Sony Music or, let's say, one of the major international players. And then there's a number of other sponsors, I imagine, who are also at some level politically connected. Do you think that makes artists a little bit lazy as well, that they know that they can go out with sort of cap in hand and think, okay, Brasilia is going to give me a little bit of money and I can get two tracks out, as opposed to maybe suffering a little bit more for your art?
There's been quite a lot of criticism, especially in the last 10 years, because since Lula was in power, he started more this culture incentive. I mean, there is a good side for it, of course, because then they kind of have a chance to become popular, but you're right, they can become a bit lazy. Even though, in the case of Genesee, I have to say, it was a good choice made by the government.
No, I
liked him.
Absolutely. You mentioned Ney Matogrosso, who we're going to hear from next. I'm glad that you haven't taken a cue out of his page, because he's gone a bit heavy on his cover here with silver jewelry. Great news for the silver mines of the country. But I'm happy to report that you haven't come back wearing eyeliner, because he likes a bit of eyeliner. He also likes a bit of a, I wouldn't even sort of call it, it's not really a feather boa. It's more like, it's sort of like feather, sort of like football shoulder pads. So anyway, glad that you've stuck away from the...
And he's 72, we should say that, right?
And he's pulling it off beautifully.
He's iconic. I mean, he's been popular since the 60s. He used to have a rock band called Secos e Molhados, and they used to pan their faces. And he still sings shirtless, actually. He was on the cover of the Brazilian version of Rolling Stone last month, and he was just wearing, well, basically nothing. Mm. And he still looks all right, you know, for 72. And he's a very polemic character, because he's been gay since the 70s, which was quite shocking to Brazil in that period. And he was always very open about his sexuality as well.
Mm. Now, this is Ney Mato Grosso. The song is Samba do Blackberry.
Exactly, the Blackberry Samba.
Mexendo feliz no seu novo. Eu não vou nem me comparar, não tenho como disputar, pois não mando e-mail, só mando essa minha situação, eu quero sua atenção. Eu já fiz, imagino até onde eu penso até em desistir.
Now, is this, I mean, the song, as I said, it's called Samba de Blackburn. Is this great news for the Canadian company that has stumbled a little bit? I mean, Alicia Keys has dropped them, so, you know, should they be signing up Ney Mato Grosso? What's he saying?
Well, I don't think so, because basically he's saying that his girlfriend or boyfriend is swapping him for a BlackBerry. So, yeah, well, it's kind of good news.
I think this is good news for BlackBerry.
Yeah, Black.
Now, if you're listening at the top of the program, we played you a little bit of a track. It reminded me of the group Inner City, taking me back to the mid 80s or late 80s anyway. This is Rio Shock with Surreal. Great, great track. I think it's probably going to find its way onto our playlist quite easily. It's Rio Shock by Surreal. And there's a bit of a connection just before we go. The gentleman behind this has been a bit of a friend of this station, hasn't
Absolutely.
He?
Absolutely. DJ João Brasil, who used to live in London, but he moved to Rio quite recently. He just had a baby, and this is his new project, which I think is going to be one of the hits of the summer in Brazil. And let's say it's summer right now in Brazil, so people are already listening to this song in the clubs in Rio de Janeiro, São Paulo, everywhere.
I think this is definitely going to go on our heavy rotation list. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, very, very good to see you. We'll see more of you throughout the week. That is all the time we have for today on this particular program, that being Midori House. And big thanks to our guests who were on a little bit earlier, of course, Xenia Dormandy and John Owen. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, was researched by our very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco right here, and also Rowena Wiles, and our studio manager has been Chris Chilvers. Up next is Section D, and we'll be reporting on what was on show at 2014's Pitti Uomo, the International Menswear Fair in Florence.
We're not trying to chase fast fashion. We're trying to establish quality clothing that people respect and want to wear, iconic pieces. So that's the main thing, really. And we just want people to understand and appreciate who we are as a brand.
At 2200, the Monocle Daily is going to be here with Andrew Mulder and Nancy Durham. And this show is going to be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London time. I'm back in this very seat at midday tomorrow for the briefing. See you then.
It tells the story of a passion for motor racing, a legend forged over time by the pioneers of speed and great drivers. The Daytona Cosmograph, the watch made to break barriers, the watch dedicated to endurance, the watch that was born to race. Rolex.